Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joshua, and my guest today is Dale Kedwitz, whose latest book is titled The Mappae Mundi of Medieval Iceland. Dale, a very warm welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Dale, we're here, of course, to talk about your book, but I think it's only right that we start from, I'd say, your origin story, because you, Dale, have quite the tale to tell, don't you? You weren't always fated to be an historian of medieval Icelandic cartography, were you?
No, that's right. I think anyone's entry point into cartographic history tends to be a bit roundabout, but in my case, I became interested in Iceland first when I came here in 2004, and I came on a geology field trip. I wanted to be an earth scientist, but I came to Iceland to study these glacial and volcanic landscapes. But while I was here, I went to a place called Safnahúsið, which is a part of the National Museum of Iceland. And there I bought, I saw some an exhibition of manuscripts, of Icelandic medieval manuscripts, and I bought in the museum gift shop my first saga, Njálssaga, and Caroline Larrington's translation of the Poetic Edda. And I remember reading them when I was in Iceland on the Laki basalts, a huge lava plain in the south of Iceland. And I was captivated, and I knew right then that I had to go to university and study literature instead of earth sciences.
And how did you make the jump from literature to history?
Well, I think my research kind of falls between the two, as a lot of map historical research does. One doesn't train as a map historian, but comes through different disciplinary branches. So I began in studying literature, and of course as a kind of extension of medieval textual culture, maps are written in language. They kind of belong to that field of philological study, but there are specialists in map history coming from literature history, art history. It's a multidisciplinary field. It needs that kind of multidisciplinary approach.
That's true. Yeah, and you did mention earlier you had an interest in geology. Do you still feel a passion for that field? Have you been able to fulfill that passion?
I mean, to an extent, they feel a lot more similar to one another than I think you would imagine. So, one of the things I remember when I was here originally studying geology was that we were taking a coach along the south coast of Iceland, and our tour guide, who was a woman called Solveig, an Icelandic woman, didn't know much about geology, but she had a lot to say about various stories attached to the landscape. And one of these I remember as a 17-year-old was her pointing out a farm on a cliffside and saying to us all, that there was an ancient Icelandic story about a farmer who lived there, who was exiled, committed to exile from Iceland for a killing, for a murder, and had to leave the country for 3 years. But on leaving, turned back and looked at his farmstead and the mountains behind them, and decided that he would rather forfeit his life and stay in Iceland than go away. And it was years later that I found out that that story is from Njálssaga. It's the story of Gunnar of Hlíðarendi, and that kind of that ability to make the landscape speak to you, either through the kind of stories, the narratives attached to the landscape, or through kind of explaining the geological processes that shaped them, feel quite nicely cognate. and actually, the places I went to study kind of these glacial landscapes in the UK, kind of fossilized glacial landscapes. So I went to the Lake District, I remember, in the north of England, with the same geology group. And some years later, when I was doing my master's in Norse and Viking studies at the University of Nottingham, we went to the Lake District yet again, but to study it from the perspective of place name studies. There's a very rich kind of Scandinavian inheritance in place names. Even some saga narratives are located in the north of England. So there's plenty of opportunities to go to the same places and study them from a kind of literary, historical, and a geological perspective. So I wouldn't say it drives my research, but it certainly kind of underpins my passion in the subject.
Yeah, surely. Well, that's a very interesting story, but it is a topic best left for another day, but it does quite helpfully bring us to the subject of today's podcast, which is your book, The Mapai Mundi of Medieval Iceland. Now, I must confess that before opening this book, I had little to no idea what a Mapa Mundi was. And as I soon found out, it's not really a map in the modern conventional sense. Could you begin by telling us what exactly the words Mapa Mundi refer to?
Yes, certainly. That's an excellent question. Literally, Mapa Mundi is it's a compound of two Latin words. Mapa, meaning something like cloth or napkin, and mundi, meaning the world, mundus. And medieval Mapai Mundi is a term that modern and very often medieval thinkers attach to these attempts to visualize the earth or a part of its surface. That said, the word Mapa Mundi didn't necessarily denote a drawing of the world. It could as well be a geographical description in written in text in literature, but what we have from these maps are attempts to visualize part of the world. Kind of counterintuitively as well, I think we assume that map history started small and got big, so we begin with local or regional depictions and then sort of graduate outwards to maps that show the whole world. but actually, the first maps we have in medieval Europe were attempts to visualize totality. So they're depictions of the whole world and maybe your place within it. But that comes much before regional maps.
Well, you've got quite a few Icelandic maps that you've referred to in this book. You've got hemispherical maps, you know, TO maps, zonal maps. I was wondering if you could tell us a useful way of categorizing these particular Icelandic Mapai Mundi that you've studied, and what would the defining characteristics of each category of these maps be?
Certainly. Medieval Europeans had a range of conventions for depicting the world in visual form. We call all of them Mapai Mundi, but as you point out, there are several kind of distinct varieties of Mapai Mundi. So the first two you mentioned, the hemispherical and zonal maps, kind of constitute a species of maps that take the entire Earth as their object. Their depictions are very much a global space. So they show the Earth as a sphere, represented as a circle, and they tend to show the latitudinal distinction of various climatic zones. This had all been theorized in antiquity. There were mathematical proofs of the Earth's sphericity done with work with shadows in antiquity. And in the Middle Ages, these maps kind of showed where the habitable portions of the Earth are. So the medieval conception of the globe was, as we know it to be, that the poles are cold and frigid, they're frozen and uninhabitable, and they had this idea that the equator, kind of just below Saharan Africa, was too intensely hot for human habitation. So they situate all of human civilization and history in the Earth's northern hemisphere. The hemispherical world maps do this by showing usually the what we call the parallels of latitude. So these are kind of theorized quantities like the equator, where the day and night are always the same length throughout the year. And then you have the polar circles in both hemispheres, where for at least one day a year you get a day when the sun doesn't rise or doesn't set. So these are kind of mathematical conjectures based on spherical geometry. That is kind of the hemispherical and zonal maps. But there are other species of medieval map which are much better known and much more talked about, which we call TO maps. And these are so called because they don't depict global space. They just depict the kind of the space inhabited by human civilization and history. So they conceptualize this as a circle, kind of we know this circle from hemispherical and zonal maps to be located on the Earth's northern hemisphere. And this circle is divided into three continental spaces. These are Africa, Asia, and Europe, divided by three waters. So you have the Mediterranean Sea, which is at the medius of Terai, the middle of the lands. That's where the name comes from. And then you have the rivers Nile and Don kind of dividing all the Earth's lands into three parts, three continental spaces. And these are the kinds of maps in which we find place names. So the world tends to be centered on the most important places in medieval Christianity, like Rome and Jerusalem. And we find various other place names written, possibly in a variety of medieval languages, but usually Latin within this circle.
Now, if we could just zoom out briefly and survey all these Icelandic maps more generally, what sets the Icelandic Mappae Mundi apart from medieval maps from elsewhere in Europe? You know, what comes to mind is, of course, the Hereford Mappae Mundi, perhaps the most well-known within the genre.
That's a very good question. The answer is precisely the reason that there hasn't been a book about medieval Icelandic Mappae Mundi until now. In that I think that there's actually not much difference in these maps. They belong to very conventional types that were copied across medieval Europe. The medieval Islamic world had its own kind of iconographic traditions for depicting the world. They're very much related to and show the same kind of world as contemporary world maps like the Hereford Mappae Mundi of around 1300, or the very important Salta maps of around the second quarter of the 13th century. The Icelandic examples were copied in Iceland. They are translated in some instances from Latin, the kind of supra-regional language of medieval scholarship, into the vernacular language, into Old Norse Icelandic. And they're interesting, really, for what Icelandic thinkers are using these for. Because, of course, we don't just encounter maps floating around in culture on their own, but they're drawn into manuscript books with other texts, with other images, and they were drawn for a reason. They were drawn so that the thinker, the author, could think through certain questions about Icelandic identity, about geography and history.
Mm-hmm. And I do have something I observed about the aesthetic quality of these maps, because unlike, say, the Hereford Mappamundi, these maps from Iceland aren't particularly, I would say, ornately decorated. There aren't many artistic descriptions of depictions of people, of places, of buildings.
Yes.
And they're mostly composed of just words, you know, arranged in concentric circles and lines. Was this a conscious choice on the part of cartographers? And would you be able to venture a guess as to why that was the case?
Yes. I mean, medieval Mappamundi could be very expensively produced and beautiful artifacts. So the Hereford Mappamundi, which is the most famous and the largest to survive to today, was this huge map painted in all sorts of colors and with gold leaf onto a single vellum, so a single calf skin. So it's this huge kind of cow-shaped map on the wall of a medieval church on Hereford Cathedral in England. Many other maps were copied into manuscript books with varying degrees of kind of artistic flair or ornamentation. The Icelandic examples are, as you say, very plain to look at. The hemispherical and zonal maps are really, we can think of them as diagrammatic. They're line drawings showing things like the equator, the tropics, the polar circles, with just lines and inscriptions on them. Whereas the Vive maps, which are the most kind of the most exceptionally detailed maps from medieval Iceland, they're not illustrated like the Hereford map, which contains, you know, 1,100 texts and pictures and various other things. But these maps are just kind of place names and very short inscriptions arranged into a vaguely geographical framework.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about Icelandic Mappamundi in particular, you talk about how they are copied instead of being created. So were any of these works conceived or produced exclusively in Iceland?
So there is a sense in which these maps are not original works. They tend to be copied from earlier maps or compiled from various written descriptions of world geography. So these maps take a lot of their information from very traditional sources, like Isidore of Seville's etymologies, like the histories of Erosius, and other medieval writers who were interested in the world and its parts. There are local, probably Icelandic contributions to these maps. So the map from Vive, produced in around 1225, 1250, is the earliest map to show the Scandinavian countries as distinctive regions. It doesn't use traditional kind of coverall vocabulary for Scandinavia, but breaks it down into constituent regions. And there are certainly other Icelandic editions that are written in Old Norse or a combination of Old Norse and Latin that are certainly original. And it's really the charge of originality that has kind of seen these maps neglected because people who have been interested in them have wanted to use them somehow as sources for I guess what the most obvious narrative that these maps could fit into would be, which is the Viking explorations of settlement and raiding, trading a few centuries earlier in the Viking Age. Of course, we know mostly from Icelandic literature that the Vikings had extensive geographical interests. And the disappointment in these maps has been that they don't really articulate much about these voyages of exploration and settlement. They're more focused on a very a very traditional but also kind of connected European view of what the world looked like. Icelanders are drawing these maps and more making the case for their Europeanness, their kind of cosmopolitanism, their connection to other European elites who were drawing the same kinds of maps centered on the same kinds of places. These maps are doing kind of important cultural work that isn't necessarily just about the Icelanders divulging their geographical knowledge at the time these maps were produced. So we find omissions that have kind of frustrated people looking at them. These maps don't show places that we know Icelanders in those periods knew, but they were never trying to do that.
Okay. So what kinds of place names do we find in these maps? And what do they tell us about, say, the influences and connections between Iceland and the wider world?
They draw from a variety of sources, as all medieval maps did, some ancient and some contemporary, and again a combination of written and oral sources. So, for example, the Vive map, which has this expansive depiction of world geography, is very interested in places talked about in the Bible, so pays particular attention to the coastal Levant and the places in Central Asia and across the Fertile Crescent, in Mesopotamia, the Parthian kingdoms, all these places that were described in Roman literature, as well as Africa. The African descriptions are prevailingly limited to the North African kingdoms subjugated by the Roman Empire. So we have this kind of influx of traditional names pulled from various sources. To these, medieval Europeans added a variety of names drawn from their more mundane local experience. So the map's depiction of Europe tends to be the most modernized, the most reflective of an interest in contemporary political structures, in what Europe might actually have been like. So only on one map do we have a depiction of Iceland, which is situated in the very northwest of the map, immediately below the inscription Europe on the map's frame. So they're very much trying to say something about where Icelanders were seeing themselves and who they were seeing themselves as connected to. And tying themselves into, yes, a wider world. But the name Iceland, as it appears on maps, is interesting, and one I do try and write a bit about. In that its earliest appearance, the earliest appearance of the name Iceland, from what I can gather, appears in medieval England on a map we call the Cotton Map, sometimes the Anglo-Saxon Cotton Map. And this map was produced at Canterbury in around 1050. And people have occasionally noticed that this map contains an inscription, Iceland. But what they haven't really noticed is that appearance of a supposedly Old Norse Icelandic place name appears before any sort of alphabetic writing in a Scandinavian language. It appears around 1050, so just after Iceland's conversion, before really we get kind of literature and books being produced in Iceland. So this place name, which is, you know, it could be Old Norse, it could be Old English. There's not much in the language to distinguish between the two versions of that place name. We have no idea of the kind of oral channels that led to an ecclesiastic, possibly a monk in Canterbury, hearing the name Iceland, which must have been from travelers' tales or reports from missionary activity. But these maps do speak to a very connected world, to a very connected Europe, and a Europe that very much looks outwards to more remote geographies as well.
Most certainly, and I think another indication of these intimate connections would be the use of different languages, which you alluded to earlier, to label different places. And even in one of the chapters, you talk about how the tropical signs of Cancer and Capricorn are labeled in the vernacular instead of in Latin. What languages were used, firstly, in annotating these maps? And what would the difference be of presenting something in Latin or something in Norse? What does it say about these maps?
This is an area in which I think research is only recently happening. So I know for sure that there's more written on this very recently in Alfred Hoyt's Dislocations. The question of language as it appears on medieval maps is ongoing. A few people now have observed that medieval maps tend to be multilingual artifacts, especially in the regions in the immediate knowledge of the map maker and audiences. So on the Hereford map, for instance, the geographical place names within the map circle are prevailingly written in Latin, but there are many names around England written in English, with perhaps a very slight preference for naming places that were very important to the church, ecclesiastically significant. They might be named in Latin, a kind of more elevated language than the local. On Icelandic maps, as a kind of philologist, I'm very interested in precisely questions about what language and translation impart and how these go into the production of maps as textual artifacts that relate to very broad literatures and histories. So I was interested in which parts of medieval Icelandic maps have Latin and which have names in other languages. And as you point out, the very technical kind of hemispherical and zonal maps, which are based on earlier medieval Latinate discourses in natural philosophy, talking about the sun's course, the earth's spherical nature. These tend to translate their inscriptions into a more easily understandable vernacular. So we have words like the circulus equinoctialis, which would be the Latin for the equator, the circle along which day and night are of equal length. That's translated into Icelandic part for part as jafndægris hringur, which isn't, interestingly, the medieval Icelandic word for equator, the modern Icelandic word for equator, which is miðbaug, like the middle ring. But it's a medieval attempt to put Latin into something more people could understand. What we see on the Vive map is interesting because we know that the Icelanders had this capacious understanding of world geography. We know from sagas that they traversed places like Byzantium, like Russia. The Vikings moved across the Baltic and through the Volga into Eastern Europe and beyond. There are reports of Vikings serving in the king's retinue in Byzantium, in Istanbul. We know that Icelanders had this capacious vernacular vocabulary for talking about places like Garðaríki, which is Russia, and Miklagarð, which is Constantinople, modern Istanbul. But they tend to use Latin on their maps, unless they're writing about places with Scandinavian presence, so the Scandinavian regions, which interestingly relates to contemporary Icelandic literature in various ways.
Now, a final thing I observed about the geographical representation in these maps is the way the maps are oriented. Now, you mentioned the zonal and the Vithe maps, which were oriented with the northern hemisphere, if I'm not wrong, at the bottom, presumably from the perspective of the Icelandic viewer looking southwards to the rest of the world. We sometimes describe maps as egocentric, you know, with the cartographer, the place of origin being the focal point of the map. Yeah. Would you say this was the case for the maps you studied?
Absolutely. I think any map has that capacity for being anthropocentric or egocentric. Either they center or they privilege a particular view on the world they seek to present. No map is a neutral or transparent record of geographical reality. So we know, for instance, with modern maps of the Mercator projection, for instance, which tends to be centered on England and kind of show the world's mid latitudes that much bigger sizes than they actually are, so that we kind of get a small Africa and a massive Greenland, for instance. These maps kind of center and privilege a particular person's vision on the world. Likewise, medieval maps, they're not transparent records of reality that culminates in that kind of modern perfect understanding of the world. That's not what they are. But rather they're built around a medieval perspective on the world. So they typically in the Middle Ages place Jerusalem at their center, because Jerusalem is the epicenter and focal point of world history and of geography in the incarnation of Christ, of course. And they tend to show a kind of Europe on the kind of edge of the map, the places where the map was produced, like England or Iceland, tend to be located far out. And this is part of a map's historical argument. So these maps are witnesses to the sort of evangelizing of the world. So the peripheral depiction of places like Iceland show that the church has diffused across the whole of the world, that they're kind of statements on the progress of world history. And on the south orientation, that's also... It's one of the insoluble problems with this corpus of maps I was working with, because as maps tend to be oriented in the Middle Ages to the etymological sense of the word. So our word to orient comes from the Latin oriens, which is east. So maps like the Hereford map tend to place east at the top. And this is in order to venerate the holy places of Christianity, which were located far away eastwards in Jerusalem and its surroundings, and also to kind of encode, as I said, this kind of historical narrative onto the map, so that you could read it in a sense from east, in which direction paradise was located. So you see the origins of humanity at the very top of the Hereford map, and you kind of climb down its historical scale into Europe and find kind of modernity in the West. The Icelandic maps are unique for all showing south of the top. And this is a sort of, it's a sort of difficult problem, because It makes sense, as you say, to depict the world kind of reaching out from your position in the north, looking southwards. So that makes very good sense. But what's strange about the Icelandic corpus is that we have various map genres depicted. So we have five maps from Iceland. We have two hemispherical maps and one zonal map. And we have two TO maps, and they all place south at the top, which is an interesting and surprising conceit to occur to a range of map makers independently. But seems to be more inspired by the models that were available to medieval copyists. Zonal and hemispherical maps were usually with north of the top, and this makes sense in kind of in drawing them, because they're kind of they're focused on the world's geometry. So going from north and the polar circle southwards makes sense. But yeah, the TO maps were very usually with east of the top. But in this case, it's the from Iceland, the TO maps are the earliest of the maps we have from Iceland. So they can't have been influenced by the extant models that we have, the other maps drawn in Icelandic books. So it's a very interesting and remarkable change, but we're not sure on why that is.
So we've been talking quite a bit about how these maps position Iceland in relation to the wider world, but the hemispherical map in particular, which you discuss in your first chapter, positions Iceland in relation to the physical universe as we know it. What can this map tell us about Icelandic conceptions of astronomy and cosmology?
That's an excellent question. And really, it pays to revisit what I said right at the beginning, the definition of mappa mundi. Because we know that mappa means something like cloth or napkin, and mundus means world. And if you're a map historian, you tend to be very interested in the mappa part and to kind of dissect what we mean by mappa, really interrogate, scrutinize that term. But we very seldom do the same with mundus. What world do these maps depict? What do they show? How far do they reach? And I think what I try and convey in the book is that mundus can kind of resonate with the modern English words world, which how it's generally translated, but also globe and earth, which are overlapping but kind of distinct meanings in English, but tend to be collapsed into one another in the Middle Ages. So for sure, the hemispherical map doesn't just show the world, but it kind of shows the circle of the moon around the spherical Earth. It shows the sun and its passage across the night sky. Of course, we're thinking about a geocentric universe. So the hemispherical map is marked with the zodiac, which is the series of 12 constellations through which the sun appears to move in the sky over the course of a solar year. And so too is the hemispherical map, a depiction of the kind of the whole physical universe and the clocked processes that we use to measure time on Earth. So the passage of the sun and the moon, the generation of the tides that they cause, these are cosmological drawings. And they intersect all sorts of medieval ideas about natural philosophy, about the order of the world and that which makes it. That they're a kind of species of a scientific diagram.
And in addition to what they tell us about the intellectual environment in which they were created, did any of these maps have, say, practical implications? You talk about how they tell tidal movements and time, for instance. Were they practically applied?
I think so in their way. I mean, they appear as illustrations in these compendious volumes of various texts and images on astronomical, natural philosophical questions. I go into this in quite some detail in my second chapter on the zonal map. What I'm interested in is not so much just the map on its own. This map only contains three written inscriptions. It's a very kind of slender artifact. But my question was, why was it drawn by a medieval thinker? What kind of intellectual work is it doing? And the way you work that out is by going through the manuscript in which it was drawn and seeing what the relations are intellectually from one item to the next. I had to be very kind of mobile with this project because when I was doing research onto the map, so I really tried to put aside any sort of preconceptions about maps and their geographical interests and what they are, what I think they are doing based on readings of maps within the confines of their own outlines. I really tried to read these books and respond to the maps as a medieval person would have seen them. So the zonal map is just one part of a kind of complement of medieval diagrams that show, quite surprisingly, I think, the structure of the physical universe. So there are four diagrams it belongs to. The first is a diagram that shows the heliocentric motions of Venus and Mercury. Medieval thinkers had reasoned that these planets must circle the sun and not the Earth, because they can never have the Earth come between them and the sun. And this makes total sense, because we know they're the inner planets. The next diagram shows the motions of the outer planets. So these are Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars. And they both explain phenomena based on their observation. So it's an observational phenomenon that we see the planets kind of rising and setting day, night in, night out, and they tend to move one way across the night sky. And of course, this is because the Earth is moving past them. But for times, they appear to move in the opposite direction, what we call retrograde motion. And these medieval diagrams were attempts to explain these kind of observational phenomena for wide medieval audiences. Then we have the zonal map in this sequence, and then we have a diagram showing the eclipses. So what we have isn't just a kind of narrow focus on global space, but really the whole physical universe. And these diagrams are providing us a background to the motions of the sun and the moon, which are so important to medieval thinkers, because it's these kind of problematic motions that mess up the calendar. So knowing when to celebrate movable feast days, like Easter, which doesn't fall on a fixed date every year, medieval people needed a science that could work out kind of squaring the lunar and the solar calendars to work out when to celebrate movable feast days. So maps were kind of providing a background context to that kind of computus operation, as we call it, explaining why the motions of the sun and the moon are so problematic to medieval notions of keeping time.
And as far as these were scientific diagrams designed specifically to understand the movements of planets and the sun and the moon, were they in any way scientifically accurate in a modern sense?
That's difficult. I mean, I think what's exciting about them is that they respond to problems we could have in kind of thinking rationally, looking at the night sky and seeing the movements of the inner or outer planets. These are difficult things to explain, and we forget that there was no Copernican model of the universe until several centuries later. And what medieval Europeans were proposing and what they took from ancient treatises on planetary kinematics, like the works of Ptolemy and other ancient thinkers, these kind of work for making sense of observations. And what you get in studying aspects of medieval science is kind of like a front row seat to people very earnestly trying to work out scientific problems. So thinking of them in terms of modern accuracy, I mean, of course, sometimes they were right and sometimes they were wrong. And there are these kind of glaring moments of kind of recognition when we see, for instance, a medieval diagram depicting the heliocentric motions of Mercury and Venus, which most people would not assign intellectually to the Middle Ages at all. But this was an accepted idea. It was in all the major astronomical handbooks of Sacrobosco and various other widely read thinkers. And I think that's the exciting thing about a lot of this material. You see very earnest engagement with big questions in natural philosophy.
Mm-hmm. But of course, you caution against interpreting maps purely for their geographical and cosmological histories. And that's what I think you set out to do at the start of this book, to examine the Mappa Mundi alongside texts that they originally accompanied and situate these maps within the wider context of contemporary vernacular literature.
Yes.
How would you say your methodology in this respect has differed from other scholars who've studied these Mappa Mundi?
We tend to study maps alongside other maps. The only thing a map historian likes better than a map is an atlas, you know, like the opportunity to study these collections of maps. And I suppose my interest and my origin into this discipline was through thinking about literature and thinking about the written record and recognizing maps as extensions of textual culture and not a kind of special interest either within literary study. So particularly in the last two chapters, the last three chapters of my book, which focus on the hemispherical world maps, I'm able to make sense of them by applying them to contemporary literatures, which are doing other things, not necessarily related to questions of geography and locality, but to thinking about Icelandic history and their social origins. Because these maps were drawn at a fascinating time. They were drawn between around 1225 and 1400. And this period saw the flowering of Icelandic literature in the vernacular, which is important for all of those of us who study sagas and Icelandic poetry. And they also appear at this moment when Iceland transitions from being a commonwealth, a republic governed by Icelandic chieftains, goðar, to a possession of the Norwegian crown in the early 1260s. So they're witnesses to huge political, geopolitical upheaval. And I've been very interested in the relationship between these maps and the kind of sovereign fantasies that Icelanders had in the period in which they were being drawn. So I relate the Vive map, which is this exceptionally detailed world map with all sorts of place names, drawn at a foundation that Snorri Sturluson, one of the great authors in medieval Icelandic literature and himself a politician, drawn at a monastery that he founded in the 13th century. So I hold the map up against his works like the opening chapters of his Heimskringla, The History of Norwegian Kings, which turns on a geographical introduction at the beginning, and also his account of the origin of Icelandic vernacular poetics, which is his kind of big compendium called Snorra Edda, which is a kind of handbook to thinking about reading, writing poetry in the Eddic tradition, drawing on Icelandic mythological figures. So what I do is compare aspects of geographical description, for sure, but also kind of stories about the origins of the Icelanders. Icelanders are doing similar things to other European elites in this period. So they're tracing their ancestry and their social origins to Troy. Medieval elites like to think of themselves as descendants of Trojan exiles following the Trojan War. And we have this in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. He relates Britain to an eponymous founder in Brutus and has this idea that the British kings derive from Brutus. And Icelanders are trying to do similar things. So what I'm trying to do with this study of maps is show that actually they don't just relate to other maps, but they relate to all sorts of literatures and histories that the Icelanders are very interested in at this time.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, you note that the hemispherical map, which appears at the beginning of the book, actually originated as a work of literary criticism. Is that right?
Yes. Well, that's right. I mean, we think about what motivates science a lot in any period, and it often wasn't just a matter of natural philosophical speculation for its own right. It was often working out your relationship to Roman literature. So when I said the hemispherical map originates as literary criticism, what I mean is that it originates in a diagram from Macrobius's commentary on the Dream of Scipio. So Macrobius was a 5th century thinker who wrote a commentary on the very last part of Cicero's De Republica, this dialogue on Roman politics compiled by Cicero. And what Macrobius does is that he wants to make sure that Cicero's description of the cosmos, which is related at the end of this dialogue, Cicero writes about his protagonist Scipio is taken up by his grandfather in a dream to look down on the earth and to look at the Roman Empire he's left behind, and it's a kind of vision in a dream about the scale of the Roman Empire, the nearness of its adversaries, and how the whole world is just a point and not very important. But there's this cosmological description in Cicero that Macrobius wants to make sure doesn't contradict Virgil. So he writes this lengthy commentary that kind of tries to square descriptions of the cosmos in Cicero's De Republica with the description of the cosmos in the works of, you know, the famous Roman poet Virgil. So literature was, in a way, one of the things people attempted to understand using science, or indeed using science to understand literature.
And I want to end this very fruitful discussion by talking about the conceptual framing of these maps. You talked earlier about how the Vithae maps emerged in what was a very geopolitically tumultuous environment in the region. And these maps, in your book, you say they were neatly organized according to what you refer to as a fourfold ordering of nature. You have four cardinal directions, four seasons, even geographically, they were sometimes divided into four quarters. What is the historical significance of this conceptual frame, and how did it help Iceland to respond to this environment of geopolitical turmoil?
Well, thank you for that question, because this is one of the entirely accidental things that can happen by reading medieval manuscripts and working from them to see what you can learn about their contents. Because when I was working with the Vithae maps, I noticed that, or many people have noticed, that they're enclosed within this kind of conceptual frame that correlates the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, with other fours that recur in nature. So, for instance, the four elements, the four ages of man from youth to old age, the four contrary qualities like hot, cold, wet, and dry, the four principal winds, the four seasons. Medieval natural philosophers used these fours to say something about the order of nature. That they're all evidence that the universe is divinely made and harmoniously structured. You can look to any part of nature and see this recurrence of four. And the four seasons are really, I suppose, the only one we've inherited today. We still talk about four seasons in English or in Europe, which is a fairly arbitrary way of dividing the year. You could do it in other ways. But when I was reading the manuscript, I saw that these maps were surrounded by these quadripartite frames, but the other item preserved with them was a register of 40 Icelandic priests. And this list is quite a, it's quite a difficult list. We don't really know why it was written, but it takes 10 priests from every quarter of Iceland. Iceland was drawn into quarters for juridical and representative purposes. So it's a kind of political structure of the Icelandic Republic. But this list takes 10 priests from each quarter. And this isn't reflective of the number of priests or anything like that. It's a very kind of symbolic gesture. But this list of 40 priests was combined with a quadripartite world map. So I noticed that actually, if you look at this manuscript, every item in it is structured around the number four. And I thought, what is a medieval thinker trying to do with this map? Why are they trying to show, or why are they bringing together an image of the Icelandic Republic, which has this four-part political structure, with a map of the world, which has a four-part kind of organic divine structure? What are they saying about Icelandic social and political institutions? And I argue in the book that they're bringing these images together to make a sort of point about the legitimacy of Icelandic political structures. As there are four seasons, as there are four elements, as there are four ages of man, there are four quarters of Iceland, and that these kind of structures emerge historically with a sort of inevitability, you know. And this makes sense when we think about the maps being produced in the middle of the 13th century, when Norwegian political encroachment was picking up, when Iceland was at the brink of becoming no longer an independent republic ruled from the four quarters, but a possession of the Norwegian crown. So what it seems to me that the map is making a point about Icelandic political structure at the time that this political structure was being threatened.
So would you say this map was in some ways conceived as a means to construct an Icelandic national identity in the face of threats to the very existence?
I think so. I think medievalists are often cautious about thinking about medieval understandings of nation and also imputing too clean and clear motives to texts that we actually do struggle to locate within time and space. You know, you can never be certain when or where something was produced. But it seems like me for sure that the map is only doing what other literatures and histories at this time are trying to do, which is trying to make a case for Icelandic distinctiveness, for Icelandic identity in a period of internecine strife, civil war, and mounting pressures from abroad.
That's very fascinating. I'll admit I've never thought of maps as a way to make a statement about, you know, the politics or the structure of a country in response, no less, to geopolitical turmoil. So it is a very interesting angle to explore.
Yeah, they very much are. Maps do a lot of political work, and deconstructing, you know, their claims to transparency or objectivity is sort of a first work of any sort of map historian working with these artifacts. There is of course a suite of reasons that maps may be drawn, and visualizing the places described in the Bible is very legitimate, and so is just plain interest in the world and its places. But I think we should always be alert to what a map is doing in its its particular context, and whether it can have any political or cultural involvements that are just lurking behind the surface.
But I think you've done a very excellent job of examining these mapae mundi from a variety of many different angles, and you've come to quite a few valuable conclusions about what they tell about medieval Icelandic thinking of that time. What do you think was the most important takeaway you had from writing this particular book?
Thank you. I think that the most important takeaway is precisely that maps don't just relate to other maps as various and complementary ways of depicting the Earth's surface. This really was the animating principle of the project. It was the thing that started me thinking about maps and how they relate to natural, philosophical, religious, political discourses. But I think what I would say the main takeaway is that Icelanders didn't always center their world on their own northern waters or the places coextensive with what we call the Viking diaspora. But they were actually able to imagine centers and peripheries within their own world, which aren't the ones we tend to assign to them in our historical research. We've tended to study even these maps for a relatively narrow range of historical questions. What do they tell us about the Baltic littorals? What do they tell us about Scandinavia? What, if anything, do they tell us about Scandinavian discovery of America? All of these questions assume something about maps and also assume something about Icelandic culture and where it was. And what I try and do in my book is to say that Icelanders are very often using maps and various geographical discourses not to focus on matters of their own exceptionalism within Europe, but on their kind of European cosmopolitanism and their relatedness to other European cultures. And I think the version of Icelandic identity that we see when we look at these maps is one that is very much in touch with the rest of Europe at this time. Not an isolated island far off doing its own thing in the North Atlantic, but a kind of an intellectual culture that is doing all the kind of voguish things that other Europeans are doing in the continent and in England, thinking about natural philosophy, thinking about history and identity.
Yeah, sure. And I think the best works of history are ones that take concepts that you don't really bother questioning, you know, the use of maps, Icelandic identity, and turn them on the head. And I think that's something you've done very well in this book. It's not a very big book. It's just 200 pages, but you've achieved a great deal in just 200 pages.
Thank you.
Well, I think we've taken up quite enough of your time today, Dale. So I'd like to wrap up with just one final question. If you could interview someone, anyone, for their new book in history, who would that be?
The book I'd like to know more about right now is Chris Callow's Landscape, Tradition and Power in Medieval Iceland. Because what Callow is interested in and what resonates with my current work is precisely this transition from Iceland being a republic, a commonwealth, to being a possession of the Norwegian crown. This book came out with Brill just in 2020, and it's very interested in questions of continuity and change across this political rupture, and in looking at various forms of Icelandic literature and historical writing to think about questions like, at this moment of big international political strife, why are the sagas so interested in recording regional or local disputes? Sometimes the main action of sagas is about disputes in regions that were no longer important in the 13th century or had ambiguous kind of relevance to the political climate. And I think for a lot of us who are interested in medieval Iceland, but also in kind of thinking about the relationship between locality and geography and history writing, that's going to be a very important book for us to think about.
Sure, and I definitely hope to see Landscape, Tradition and Power in Medieval Iceland by Chris Callow on the New Books Network soon. hopefully we'll have that to come in the coming weeks. Well, I've very much enjoyed our conversation today, Dale. It's been truly enlightening, and it's interesting to see how medieval maps are packed with so many layers of meaning. It's helped me, and I'm sure many of our listeners, appreciate maps in a very different light. So thank you very much. We'd definitely love to have you on the program again.
Thank you very much.
On that note, thanks for your time, and thank you for listening to this episode of New Books in History.